Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure to visit. This is my second time at Perimeter. I should say I know that there are several talks today, so I'll keep this reasonably brief. This is a work on primordial and Gaussian topological structure in collaboration, mainly based on basically a single paper and various follow-ups with Neil Dalal, who is at CETA, Olivier Doré, who was at CETA, he's now at JPL, and one of my postdocs in Chicago, Carlos Cunha, who is also doing a lot of the work on this topic. Also, I wasn't exactly sure what the audience is, but I see it's mostly, theoretical cosmologists, I guess. So I have maybe a couple of slides of intro that are probably maybe too basic, but at the danger of repeating some stuff you know. We have an interesting era when universe became transparent, 380,000 years after the Big Bang, when we observed the cosmic microwave background, whose temperature then was 3,000 Kelvin, but today is about 3 Kelvin. A factor of 1,000 of size later. And here's one of the maps of the CMB observed by the WMAP experiment that's used, and this, of course, the distribution and size of these spots is used to constrain cosmology. And in particular, this has been referred to as the cosmic Rosetta Stone. The angular power spectrum, which is distribution of power across various scales, is a very important discriminator between cosmological models. So it turns out if one expands temperature in these coefficients ALM, these band power CL, which are really averages across the sky of the ALM for any fixed L, contain all information in a certain limit. And that limit says that that map is Gaussian. And also, there's some more detailed information, maybe that you have the full sky information. But in the Gaussian limit, these coefficients have all information, and they've been studying to get a lot of things. You don't have to read this, obviously. These are standard cosmological parameters determined when I speak to non-cosmological audiences. They're not necessarily aware that in cosmology we get these 1% accuracies, but for this audience it's unnecessary. But the one point I'm making here is that you can constrain also many more exotic quantities in the universe that have been discussed in this impressive Komatsu et al. 2008 paper. But basically, to step back a little bit, here we have this temperature in the sky. And the question is, what is the structure of this map? Generic inflationary predictions, which are, as always arguable, state the three things. That you have nearly scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations. And that's been verified to a pretty good accuracy with the recent WMAP experiments. Then you have generically a background of gravity waves, which is much more difficult to verify. And finally, you have nearly Gaussian initial conditions. And this certainly holds for simplest models of inflation, which have single scalar field, slow roll, and they have standard kinetic term in the Lagrangian. Again, I think everybody knows this, but maybe just repeat now. Something that maybe not quite everyone, certainly in cosmology, is aware of. People often say, oh, assuming Gaussianity, you know, you use the CLs. But it's good to take that apart a little bit and see where isotropy assumption and where Gaussianity assumption comes in. Isotropy comes from the fact, so you have those temperature coefficients. If you make the correlator of ALM, AL prime, M prime over different realizations of the universe, then you get a quantity that has L and L prime and M prime. And that quantity is only a function of L in this isotropic limit. So in this limit, that only becomes CL. So that's where assumption of isotropy comes in. And then the assumption of Gaussianity comes in where basically you realize that all odd point correlation functions of the ALM are zero, and all even point correlation functions are just a function of the two-point function. So that's also quite easy to understand. So this is where. So this immediately suggests you can test isotropy if you like. That's a good thing to do. But Gaussianity, to test Gaussianity, the simplest thing to do is clearly it's presented right here. You take three-point correlation function on temperature, and you verify within the error bars, is it consistent with zero or not? And of course, this tests then inflation and the early universe. Now, there are various types of three-point triangles that you can take on the sky. You can, first of all, work in real or in Fourier space, if you like. But generically, people talk about two particular configurations that have significant power. One is a local configuration where two sides are much bigger than the third side. And this, whatever non-zero amount it is, that's what standard inflation predicts. So the power mostly comes with such configurations in the sky, the three-point power. And then you have equilateral configurations which some other models of inflation predict. And maybe not many people are necessarily familiar, but David Schramm, who was a famous cosmologist, University of Chicago, he was one of the founders of modern cosmology, so to speak. He worked on many topics in the early universe, phase transitions and so on. But I guess not many people are aware that he actually is one of the first people to work seriously on non-Gaussianity. And here's the Luo and Schramm paper from 1993. I remember talking to one of his graduate students in 96 or 97 when I started grad school, and he told me he works on non-Gaussianity, and first I asked him, well, what does it mean? And then, what isn't the universe Gaussian? So I didn't even understand what, so Schramm worked on it in the early days. Jeff Jewell, who now works at JPL, he works on nitty-gritty things with foregrounds. Again, some of the simple stuff for theorists at least. So non-Gaussianity turns out to be proportional to slow roll parameters of inflation. And then one arguably reasonable model that almost everyone is talking about, the most popular model, is this FNL model of local Gaussianity. This turns out to be a model that produces local, that squeezed triangle form of non-Gaussianity, where the full gravitational potential is equal to the Gaussian part plus FNL times Gaussian part squared. To set scale, basically, in fact, inflation predicts this parameter FNL to be not maybe exactly zero, but something like 1 or 0.1. So in this business, this parameter of unity is considered very, very small. This parameter has to be 100 or 1,000, positive or negative, for us to call it big and for it to be easily seen. I'll show that in a few moments. But of course, more exotic inflationary models, which theorists tell me are actually maybe more reasonable inflationary models, can produce observable non-Gaussianity as well as other forms of non-Gaussianity. And so here's a little bit of a brief history of non-Gaussianity measurements. In the 1990s, Kobe appeared to show the Gaussian temperature fluctuations in the sky. And then in 1998, there was a very interesting claim of non-Gaussianity at multiple of 16. Unfortunately, this graph is very pale, and I couldn't get in any other form, but let me describe what's shown here. On the x-axis here, we have value of the bispectrum for equilateral triangles. So this is L1 equal to L3 equal to L2 equal to L. So L is shown here, and this is really unfortunate. This came out completely pale. This is 2, 4, 6. In steps of 2, this is L, at which bispectrum. So on the x-axis is the bispectrum. On the y-axis, you have histograms that kind of look like this. They are distributions of the bispectrum from Gaussian random simulations. So distributions, histograms look like this. And then the vertical line is measurement from COBE. Okay, so you can't see everything, but trust me on the fact that all of these fall somewhere in the middle of the histograms, and only at L of 16, this is L of 16, this line falls at the tail of the histogram. It's not far on the tail. It's something like 95, 97% on the tail. So I don't know if I need to draw it, but you'll get the picture. The histogram here looks like, it's low by the time you get here. So they actually claimed at L of 16 that you have evidence for non-Gaussianity. The equilateral bispectrum at L of 16 its value is larger than you would expect in 95% of realizations. So sorry, that's not visible at all. Even on my screen, couldn't get a better graph of that. But this, interestingly, was explained by a known systematic effect. These authors showed that actually 2 months in a year, COBE goes in a shade of the Earth. It's shaded. And if you take out that data, the effect goes away. If you reanalyze the data with that, if you go to the time stream, take out those 2 month periods, then the effect goes away. And anyway, this nowadays that we are a bit maybe more sophisticated about statistics, we know that this is not unexpected, because if you look at this many multiples, even if you just pick a bispectrum, you expect one of these to be maybe 2 sigma. So you can't just look one of them and claim some big thing. So that's already been pointed by Komatsu long ago. And nowadays, of course, we wouldn't make a big deal out of something like this. But these were interesting early days of this. This is the first time I heard about non-Gaussianity seriously when Chris Gorski made a fuss about this at one of the conferences.
Stupid question, shade with respect to the sun?
I think so, yeah. That's right, shade with respect to the sun, yes. I don't know any more about it, but it's a systematic effect. I asked some experimentalists, they're like, oh yeah, systematic shift. That data, when you go from sun to shade, bad things happen. Okay, pre-WMAP, the Famkin's Gaussian, there's this Proti Wu et al. Paper, and they are doing test by test, they're saying Gaussian, Gaussian, Gaussian. You know, they do various tests on maps for maxima. And then before WMAP, pre-2008, everything's Gaussian, and then the work constraint was between minus 36 and 100. And so my next bullet point comes with this graph. In December 2007, there was an interesting claim of non-Gaussianity in WMAP by Yadav and Wandelt that claimed, I forget, that went something like 99 or 98%, it was certainly more than 95. So 95% error excludes zero. And here's what's shown there, also a little bit pale. On the y-axis, you have FNL, and this is a zero value. On the x-axis, you have the maximum multiple out to which you analyze data. So you have, this is basically minimum scale out to which you go. And going to the right is going to smaller scales. And so these are the two sigma error bars. And there are three, several curves. One is, these are different maps that you take. So basically, you see that you don't get the non-zero result at two sigma if you don't go to scale small enough. But if you go to these scales, maybe smaller than LMAX of 500, then you get, you barely squeeze out, at least if you look at this picture, to a sigma result. Okay, and they also to be noticed is, of course, right around this point is where experiment becomes noise dominated, which means you know, data analysis gets a bit more, in other words, understanding of the data gets a bit complicated from this point on. So that might be a warning signal. But anyway, that was a claim. It, of course, got people interested.
If you go to lower L's, this is a curve that goes and centers around zero.
Right, so this is the highest L you go out to. Oh, yeah, I don't know how it behaves if it centers at zero. Somebody may know, but
I think that, well, the number of samples starts reducing, so the sample
right.
Zero is getting much bigger as well.
Right, that's a good point. Because you're doing triangles, so there, I don't know if the number goes as number of points cubed, but it goes very sharply as you go to smaller scales. And so clearly, as you go to higher, you're really getting a huge number of new triangles as you move to smaller and smaller scales.
When you say that's the scale that the company is on, do you mean for pixels of that size, the RMS fluctuation of the noise is bigger than 10 minus 5?
No. Well, I'm not sure. But I, what I mean is that, you know, there's cosmic variance errors on small or large scales. And then on small scales, there's error due to the fact that, you know, basically resolution... The angular resolution of WMAP is somewhere here. So that's the breakpoint between the two. And so here you can use cosmic variance. Certainly here you can use cosmic variance, but here the other one dominates. And so that just makes it tricky. Resolution is L of 400 is half a degree, and their resolution is like a quarter of a degree, but it's that's where it becomes messy. Not messy, but just noise dumping, you know. Resolution beam, yes. Okay, and much better constraints in the future from Planck. Whether it's error 5 or 10, I'm not sure, but something like that. But here's going back to WMAP 5-year data. And they've repeated this analysis. But notice you have a choice. Which map are you going to use? Are you going to use the raw cleaned? Which mask are you going to use? Are you going to use smaller or bigger mask to mask out the galaxy? And depending on that, you get different results. But just picking some representative values here, you see it's hovering around 2 sigma, but it's not quite. Anyway, so that, you know, they basically, you know, qualitatively result is the same. But then, of course, everything is in the precise values of these things. And they're hard to determine. You know, they depend on which map are you using and so on. Okay. Now, this also might be related to something else I've been working on that I won't talk about. But actually, I'll talk about this tomorrow at CETA, of all places. But I won't talk about here today, which is so-called anomalies on large scales in the CMB. And one of them I'm showing here. This is kind of a popular picture. It doesn't have much detail. This is a two-point angular correlation function of the CMB as a function of scale. And this is prediction by the lambda CDA model with the main value. And this is, I think, one sigma band. And so our sky, and of course, this is not detail. I'm not telling you which map. But basically, if you take what we think are most reliable maps of our sky, you get something that's close to zero from 60 to 180 degrees. It's hard to judge by eye. But if you do various statistics, you find this is very significant. This actually significance has grown from COBE to WMAP 1 to WMAP 3 and 5. So, you know, this might be a hint that this is a real signal when you see more and more significance as your data becomes better. Maybe one thing I want to show here, especially because there are many, many people here are theorists. If you talk to theorists and maybe you mention anomalies in large scales, most will say, oh, yes, I've heard of that. Quadrupole is low. quadrupole is low. And what I'd like to argue strongly here is that quadrupole is actually not even low. A quadrupole is low at maybe the 10% or 90%, however you want to quant probabilities. It's not even 2 sigma. It's not very significantly low. What's more significant is the fact that quadrupole and octopole and the next one and the one after, they all conspire in a way to make the C of theta, the angular power, low. So if you're building theories to explain these low power anomalies, a much better thing than the quadrupole is to look at the C of theta and see if you can explain, you know, if your theory can show that to be low rather than the quadrupole. Because really, the significance is not in the quadrupole, even if you want to argue about this number or argue about this whole thing. Quadrupole isn't.
So I think this, if that was the one sigma error bar, I don't think why is that not 2 sigma? I mean,
Right, because it's not, this significance is not departure from theory, but it's closeness to zero. So this is, you're right, these are also correlated, but the closeness of this to zero is what I quoted here, as opposed to departure from theoretical. See, so in other words, I can almost say the theory already maybe is close to zero or something, but it's closeness of this to zero that's more significant than departure from theory. It's really what got people excited here is that this is vanishing. It's zero. And, you know, there are, like, there's many more details here to be filled in, but not even so much that it's far from theory.
I see. So you're saying if I was to do bad simulations, then I would only get very small number that
had
that extensive.
Yes.
So here, when you have the R star, you have, can you cut the second part of the star and then calculate the C theta, right?
Yes.
And so if you do that for theory, how do you cut that? For each theory, you cut it the same way that you cut
it. You can cut it for, if you don't want to think much and just want to get, then you would dig for theory, you'd also cut the mask and do it. But for theory, because theory is isotropic by construction, not cutting will produce the same result as cutting, except with different error bars, slightly. But cutting and not cutting. Yes, because if I take a random map that I know is isotropic, and I compute C of theta, now I cut it, I compute C of theta, they may differ. But if I average over many such repetitions of doing that, then it'll be the same on average by construction, because I know outside of the cut and the full thing will be the same on average. Well, on our sky, it may not be, of course.
What about causal invariance? I'm not referring to the Bloch sign. The cosmic, you can't eliminate.
There is cosmic variance, right, but the measurements are. Well, one has to be a little bit careful because, first of all, cosmic variance depends on the size of the power spectrum. So if this power spectrum, which I'm not showing, in whichever units you want to think about it, if it's really low, then its cosmic variance error will be much lower as well. Because error in CL goes to CL. You know, that's kind of what I'm saying. So if CL is low, error in CL goes low. And I'm not sure. So that's one thing. It's not shown here. All I'm arguing is that the measured thing is very unusually close to zero. And this number includes comparing to simulations. So it includes error. When you compare, in other words, to simulations, you take error into account for sure. I didn't plot it here, but you could. But maybe I didn't answer that question completely. But anyway, that's. Error is taken into account, and the error in our sky, cosmic variance, may be a lot lower if the power is low. Okay, so that's all I'm saying is this may or may not be related. This isotropy may or may not be related to Gaussianity. We have no idea if there's any relation between this or any Gaussianity observed or not in the sky. Because these two, you can have, depending on the physical model, you can get any combination. You can have Gaussian, not an isotropic. You can get the other way around. You can get both or neither. All right, so now going back a little bit to Gaussianity. So here's basically the big picture of what you can expect to do in the future. And this is kind of a roadmap. Here's the scales in the universe. This is going to smaller scales. On larger scales, you can measure use CMB. On intermediate scales, you maybe use largely structured galaxies. And then maybe on smaller scales, also you use clusters. Although if you use clustering of clusters, then you're really in this regime. So galaxy clusters, if you count their number, you are here, but maybe if you look at their clustering. And then this also shows constraints on the y-axis on FNL, and some of them have already been excluded by the CMB. And this picture has essentially been updated in the meantime. But this is just kind of a big picture. So now, one thing to look at is the abundance of dark matter halos, the abundance of virialized objects in the universe, of virialized halos, which is a probe of non-Gaussianity, as has been known for a long time. And the reason is clear. Objects, say galaxies and clusters, they form at the high end of the probability distribution of density in the universe. So if you make the initial conditions non-Gaussian, you tilt that distribution. And what especially gets tilted is the tail as you tilt the distribution. So the number of objects changes. It's as simple as that. I don't have that simple picture here, but that's what happens. There's amplitude of mass fluctuations, things that people who work in this know very well. And I don't know what I'm showing here. I guess these are just some generic outputs of a simulation. But the quantity I'm talking about is called the mass function. And this is a little bit of a code name. This is really means the number density of halos or of galaxies, say, or clusters per mass and potentially per redshift as well. So the number dndm or d log n, d log m. And that number falls very rapidly as you increase with mass, because higher mass objects, you get much fewer. So the question is, how does this generic prediction change if you have non-Gaussianity? By the way, most of what we know about the number of mass function is known from simulations. So there are some famous old approaches to do this. One of the most famous papers in cosmology is a Press and Schechter 1974 paper that says that the number density of halos is basically proportional to the fraction of collapsed objects. So this is a key, and this is just changing some units. And the fraction collapsed objects is an integral from certain threshold that depends on mass to infinity of the Gaussian PDF. This is just a pure Gaussian distribution. And then there's a famous factor of 2 that's a fudge factor. They said, well, this is counting overdense objects, but it's not counting underdensities, so let's multiply by 2, and hopefully that works. And so if you put this here and take this derivative, which you can do analytically, you immediately get the famous Press and Schechter function that survived for several decades now. It still is not actually a bad fit. It's not a terrible fit to the data. And then you can have various schemes. Some of them go under the name of extended Press Schechter, which is extremely confusing because, as far as I can tell, there are two meanings of this phrase in cosmology. And one of them means this. It means do the same thing, except replace the Gaussian PDF with a non-Gaussian probability density function. So just use the same thing, except stick in the non-Gaussian distribution that, for example, your favorite inflationary model predicts. So you put that here, and maybe you can do a derivative analytically. You have to work a little bit. That's been done by various authors. But this is really what one can do. And then one can check how well that agrees. But the point of the matter here is that there's no reason, and I might have a bullet point about that, there's no reason why any of this should work. So this one seems to work. But that already was a little bit of a fudge. And now this is second fudge on top of that first fudge. So there's really no fundamental reason why this approach should work. So we and others, a couple of years ago, have been motivated to do numerical simulations to check whether these approaches produce the mass function, this quantity that you can do in simulations. And here's just a picture of how those simulations look. This is the same simulation, and maybe one view through it, given with the same initial conditions. So you're seeing the same structure. And here's a Gaussian case. And here's when you have, positively skewed and negatively skewed non-Gaussianity. And you can see the structures here being more elucidated and less here. But one really impressive thing is to just see how little difference, how huge an FNL you have to see. And you have to have 5,000 to very clearly see it by eye. So this shows you how little non-Gaussianity is produced by inflation, because remember I said FNL of order unity, and here you have to go to thousands to see it by eye. So we did this paper I showed that really Neil Dalal is the one that ran simulations, and also Alex Shirokov. The measured mass function is shown here, measured now under, I like this word measured, that's used in simulations. It took me several years to get used to that, you know, they measured something from a simulation, but it's all from a simulation. But this is inferred from a simulation of the mass function. Here's mass, and here's the mass function. And here you see how it varies for different non-Gaussian parameters. And here's the ratio of those two. And of course, it's at high mass end when you see the most difference when you have non-Gaussianity. So it's been known for a long time, at least 10 years, that if you have to go to high masses and these very rare objects, galaxy clusters, and they will help you differentiate between non-Gaussian models. Now, one really cool thing that Neil and Delivier figured out when we were doing this was that if you look at one individual cluster, you can notice the following thing. This is, remember, it's the same initial conditions. So you can repeat the simulation and you can say, let's look at that same cluster again. You know it's going to be there. Cluster being like a halo of dark matter. And here it is in non-Gaussian simulation. But you see, if you have positive FNL, that's a bigger halo or cluster. If you have negative FNL, then it's smaller. So in fact, its mass changes with FNL in a way that can be predicted from simulations. So then we had the following idea. If I go back to this picture of the simulation, usually to fix up these predictions for non-Gaussianity, people want to see how they want to change the number density, dndm, the n in that expression, right? But instead, what we saw is that you can, in fact, change mass of a dark matter halo in a predictable way. So instead of changing the y-axis here to get these predictions, you can actually do shifting in the x direction just by knowing how mass changes. And use the same formula, but just change the mass. So go from some Gaussian mass to some non-Gaussian, which is shown here. So here's a Gaussian mass, and here's a mass in non-Gaussian realizations. So that's what we did. And here's a graph of the distribution. This is a Gaussian mass, and this is a non-Gaussian value. And of course, if you had just Gaussianity, this would be a 45-degree line, which is a dashed thing, with symmetrical error. But because you have, in this case, a Gaussian realization on the y-axis, you see preferential shift to more massive objects as you go to high mass. You see preferential shift to above 45-degree line. And this is something that can be calibrated. So what we calibrated is this relation between these two parameters as a function of FNL. But you see there's a shift, there's a mean, and then there's a scatter in that relation. Does that make sense? So here it is. Here's a solution of that. This graph is not saying much. It's just saying that things agree. But that relation that I just showed itself can be represented as a Gaussian function. So basically that thing I showed on the previous graph has mean of this much and scatter of that much, and so it has depends on FNL, on non-Gaussianity parameter. Okay, it turns out this is sufficient, and now the really nice thing comes in is that if you look at the mass function of a non-Gaussian case, and if you have a mass function of the Gaussian case, all you need to do is, according to this prescription, is something very simple. You need to do this integral. You need to convolve the Gaussian function with this shift in mass, and the shift in mass is described by a Gaussian e to the minus, you know, this squared, whatever.
So you assign this a SIP distribution called mappings. Can you explain? I mean, I would have thought there's sort of a monotonic response, like if you start with a heavy cluster, then it's going to be more accentuated, and if you start with a weak cluster, it's not going to be accentuated enough. But if you have scatter, that would imply to start with a weak cluster, and it would be more massive than more massive cluster.
Oh, I see. You don't expect. Oh, I see. Usually, people take for granted that it could be scattering relations, but you are actually asking why is there scatter?
Yeah.
Why? Why is there scatter? Yeah. Well.
You seem to be saying that the more massive clusters are less effective.
Yeah, certainly. That's actually a good, that might be surprisingly hard to answer that question, because there is, of course, noise in simulations as well. And in any given realization.
I was puzzled about that. What is M0 and
M0? This is mass, Gaussian mass, this is a non-Gaussian mass. Subscripts are confusing, I agree.
So there are Gaussian and non-Gaussian both the same, it's not some like initial.
It's the same realization?
Right. Oh, I forget if it's a direct shift. It's compared fairly. But I don't remember if it's...
It's clear that as you go to high mass, that you don't get many that go under.
Right, at high mass, it's cleaner. That's a good point. And it's really, here, they're all above. And it's really at low mass. And of course, this relation is going to revert because you have to conserve mass at low mass, you're going to get the opposite effect.
Yeah, so I guess if there's a bit of a bowing, I guess you get a bit of a bowing.
Right.
Yeah. I
would still expect that to be a one-to-four map for any given realization.
Yeah, so I wonder, so my guess would be that like you get a low mass. This is the point that I think it might be a little confusing. It would be interesting to give you precise data about it. And that is, so as you go to those lower masses, are you really sure that you've got the same one?
Right. No, that's a good question. So again, Neil Dalal is the guy who does this. I don't know this from first principle. The one thing I can say is scatter is reasonable to me because if you know these objects, even if I have two halos and only one is shown here, they look different. They're really visualized in a different way. So there's no reason to believe why they should respond in exactly the same way to this. They respond differently, and that's where the scatter comes from. So I think it's just not every halo of mass. Of this mass looked exactly like that, then you'd be right, I think. But because I can have another halo that maybe looks spherical that has the same mass, it may scatter differently as you introduce no Gaussianity.
Well, I think the question is, in what sense does it matter? So do you not care about matching maps halo to halo? I mean, does it matter that it was the same one? I mean, because there's not a conservation of final halo number at all, right? I mean.
Right, maybe you don't care that it's the same one. Maybe you care only it's the same mass.
So you just want to match.
Yeah, very close to see.
Yeah, but so there's going to be also multiple. I mean, that would be if everyone was a single halo. Right? But a lot of these are merger problems.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. I don't remember the x-axis there, but as you go to low enough masses, that there could be actually like interactions going on between halos. So you had one halo. And another halo, one got much more massive because of non-Gaussianity sort of thing.
Yeah.
And so that's why you end up with some halos, even with higher F and L, you end up with less mass than they do in the Gaussian pixel.
Good point.
Sorry
for correcting that.
No, that's a good point. And
I remember seeing talks by Neil where he shows bigger blobs to these simulations, and my recollection is, for the largest mass halos, they're essentially. If they were there in one simulation and he tunes up or down the non-Gaussianity, they're always still there. But for smaller halos, you can have a little bit of popping in and out of the halos. And so maybe that might explain why
they're
scattered.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, and clearly Neil is the person to watch because he's done this.
Yes. About the mass function.
Uh-huh.
So it looks like you showed the mass function, that's the mass function today. And it looks like you always see it in the most massive halos at any given era. So does that extrapolate down in redshift that at basically your M star cutoff is becoming F and L dependent as a function of redshift? And does that change like halo formation times? That for a given mass halo you expect it to form earlier in F and L?
I don't know if I know the answer. This, I think, is easier to distinguish if we go to high Z. But now you're asking, how does the halo formation time change? Yeah, presumably it changes as well, but not sure. Maybe someone here knows. You're talking about the history of, are you talking about the history? I am asking about the history of this shift.
Right, when you plot the mass function there, that's for Z of 0, right?
Yeah, right.
And so you're seeing a discrepancy in 10 to the 15 solar
yes.
mass things. Because those are the biggest things that exist today. I'm asking at redshift 10, ish, when the biggest things around were 10 to the 5 solar masses. So you see the discrepancy in how many 10 to the 5 solar masses things you have back at redshift 10. So as a result,
I think you do. I think you do.
Mass,
I think
that mass is going to form earlier for higher F and L or later for lower.
Yeah, I think you do.
I think the effect is the biggest stuff, which is why, for example, the bias thing happens at very large scales. So it's really just fine. Like whatever is bigger has a bigger effect.
This is non-Gaussianity is better probed using this at high Z, but I'm trying to remember if it's bigger. There must be a bigger discrepancy in these as well.
You're saying maybe the discrepancy is bigger at early Z and it goes away.
Just that where the discrepancy is in the mass function shifts in mass as a function of Z.
Oh,
But then if it's gone away by low Z.
Well, no, it's not gone away, but it used to be at 10 to the 8 solar masses, the discrepancy, the F and L dependence, and now it's at 10 to the 15 solar masses.
Is there some kind of soft similarity?
Is the reason that it's not at 10 to the 8 solar masses anymore today because those things have grown or because it's gone away?
I would think it would be because you're no longer in the tails. So a 10 to the 8 solar mass fluctuation today isn't really in the tails of the Gaussian. It's more that it's not that uncommon to have a 10 to the 8
solar mass. See a 10 to the 8 solar mass cluster at a time, you might not expect it to see one.
Right. I'm just saying, so I thought the way clustering happens, more or less, you formed a cluster of a certain mass, and then, you know, say that its mass hasn't changed by orders of magnitude by today. And so, that's the case, even if you have outliers formed, even if 10 to the 10 solar mass got very uncommon and say Richard 10, because you had very big fluctuation, and then it'd be hard to see how they could have fluctuated.
I think the point would be much
come with
this. So yes, that
they're swamped by a lot of other guys, actually.
They're swamped. So the point is that the biggest. Mass agglomerations didn't work truly from real, but you can't, instead of 10, you can't tell because they haven't reached the critical density for the whole, you know, what's eventually going to be the 15 solar mass thing as a big, you know, big 10 to the 8 solar mass central halo that you can distinguish. And it's going to one day grow up to be as big. But you can't really tell.
Well, let me say something else maybe here, and then we move on because this is actually not even the most important thing. There's observed cluster with mass of, I forget, 5 times 10 to the 14, I'm making up the number, at Z of 1.4, I think, recently. And this is a common NL. This can be explained by primordial Lagrangian, though you need very large FNL for that. So clearly, that is, I think the short answer is yes, you can look at that. You don't expect this cluster to be there in a Gaussian, and they claim it's 10 to the minus 3 probability, and you do expect it if you have FNL of 200. It's a G at all, a J-E-E. Might be Canadian.
Unless
we're doing
the analysis.
Well, the analysis. Oh, okay, yeah.
Because
okay, right. Yeah, which mass function they're using is, yes. Oh, right, yes. Anyway, but in principle, that's one way to, yes. And okay, so now I'm just going to say that, yes, that formula works, obviously, because otherwise we wouldn't have written about that. But here's, unfortunately, ugly looking plot. But what we found there is that if you take this old Press-Schechter type, extended Press-Schechter formalisms for certain FNL again, this is the ratio of the non-Gaussian to Gaussian as a function of mass. You get with those formalisms these dashed and dotted lines, and they predict a bigger effect than our simulations, which is the error bars, and then here's our fit. So we found that they overpredict the effect if you use these formulae, and that's, of course, mirrored in the cosmological parameter constraints from future surveys. This is some analysis that I've done, the equation of state and FNL, so the y-axis is important. So because they overpredicted the effect, they underestimated the error, and we think the error is bigger. Now, there's some other footnotes here. I really want to get on to the next thing. But let me just say, people in the meantime, some authors have worked, and they said these other EPS approaches, they actually work provided you make a fudge in those formulae. You make another fudge in those formulae, then they work. And Sarah has worked on it too. So there's a long literature on this. But the bottom line is, if you look at these constraints from this very quick and dirty analysis that I've done for our paper, look at the constraints. They are not very good. And even if you believe some other, they're not very good. So this mass function alone is not a good discriminator relative to the CMB. However, I'd like to say a little bit more about developments where you can actually use the correlation of objects in the sky to much more accurately calculate non-Gaussianity or constrain it. And here's, just in case, equation for bias. So bias of dark matter halos, or just bias in astrophysics, is defined as the ratio of the clustering. I wrote this slide for various audiences, including high energy experimental physicists and so on. So it's ratio of the clustering of galaxies relative to the clustering of dark matter. So it's really delta rho of halos or galaxies or clusters, I'll use that word interchangeably, relative to delta rho over rho for the background distribution of dark matter. So typically, we can predict clustering of dark matter from theory, and we can measure clustering of dark matter halos from the sky, and the two don't match, we also have to worry about this bias. So if you're a cosmologist, theoretical cosmologist in particular, then this bias is a nuisance parameter, maybe it's a function, and you just want to marginalize over it and get on with your life without, you know, really, it's not, doesn't apparently carry important cosmological importance. Now, one thing to know is that the bias is constant on large scales, of course, if you have a Gaussian distribution. So here are simulations from Sedak and Warren. Don't worry about the one that draws the eye. There was little high mass. That one is didn't have enough resolution to get that. But if you look at all the cases, this is as you increase the mass, what you find on large scales on low k, b is constant. The bias is constant. It's scale independent. And it does become scale dependent potentially as you go to higher scales. There's a very voluminous literature about this, including one paper that came out a couple of days ago by Tinker et al. People have studied this for a long time, and I myself am not nearly an expert in this. So what we found is that if you have initial non-Gaussian conditions, then this bias picks up a very strong scale dependence. So on large scales, this goes as k to the minus 2. So normally you have just this constant value, but if you have FNL, so if you have non-Gaussianity of this form, then you add a new term that looks like FNL times constant divided by k squared. And there's a way, I think, to derive that very quick and dirty without getting all the factors right. So we have been starting from this model that has a non-Gaussian field as a Gaussian plus FNL Gaussian squared. Well, you can take a Laplacian, and you can get this equation. And maybe you're working around the peaks, so maybe you're ignoring terms that look like a gradient. And so basically, you get Laplacian of the non-Gaussian field is Laplacian of the Gaussian plus this correction that depends on the field itself. So things are changed. In particular, the threshold for collapse in these non-Gaussian cosmologies is the old threshold. But now you have this correction that's in fractional correction is 2 FNL times phi. Okay. Well, then you can look at the bias of objects. So halo over density is equal to B times the dark matter over density. And so this is a formula I wrote on the previous page. If you now reinterpret the bias, then you can basically read it off. So if you have so bias, so I'm writing this, and the delta is changed in non-Gaussian cosmology to this value. If I reinterpret this as a change in bias times a good old delta, then I can literally read off delta B from this equation. And I will not only read it off, I will, in fact, introduce you know, a couple of corrections. Use in particular a Poisson equation to go from phi to delta. And that Poisson, from the Poisson equation, because that changes in phi, and I will work in units of delta, I'm going to pull down 1 over k squared. So this k squared comes from Poisson equation. But basically, the correction, again, is what I mentioned. It's equal to the old bias times FNL. And really, in the present-day coordinate, this is bias minus 1. Don't worry about that. This is FNL. And then it's proportional to some known factors from cosmology. There's a transfer function. There's growth. But the important thing is 1 over k squared. So we've derived this. And this is really kind of a royal we, really Neil Dalal. He derived a couple of different ways. I thought he did really did a phenomenal job on this. I was really amazed that he got a lot of something out of nothing. And then let me just finish this thought. Other people have also done it many different ways. They made the same derivation. Including Afshordi and Tolly.
Did that derivation motivate the simulations, or was this a...
No, Neil ran simulations. He said, oh, I have a bug. And then he propagated, then he derived the bug from theory, and that's why I was really amazed that he was able to do that. But yeah, completely serendipitous.
Sorry, he ran dark matter simulations,
had a halo finder.
Okay.
Did a halo finder, so he found halos. And so he was able, the quantity, right. Basically, he, you know, you have your P of K you put in, but you measure P halo. But it's a bit more complicated. He didn't do a P halo. He did a slightly related thing. So the first approximation, yeah, the serendipitous.
So, okay, so I can see that on the scales that have undergone collapse, then this may be true. But if I take it to the extreme, I take it to the horizon scale, I've got purely linear perturbations, I don't have collapse. My bias, that cannot extrapolate to k horizon, right?
Well,
there's got to be some fit back to, you know, the baryons called that matter, don't even, baryons don't care about k
need a cluster.
But this is for a collapsed object.
This is for collapsed objects.
So, okay, so for looking at plot like that, you go to k of 0.01. If I'm to go to k of 10 to minus, you know, there must be some rematching back to a bias of 1, basically, right?
I'm not so sure. Because you have, I mean, okay, I don't understand this that fully, but you have halos of mass M, and then you can look at their clustering on scale K. So this is saying for K, this is how it goes, period. And I agree, there's a little bit of an open question, but I don't think it's automatic that it has to go to anything. So I think you might be talking about halos of mass M becoming like M of the universe or something. But
right.
We are not. We're stopping at 10 to the 5th. You know, you never find any... There's no M here. I guess M is hidden here in this term. So this is where you have normal clustering of halos of mass M. Whatever that was, you apply the correction. Does that make sense?
Well, I was a little bit... You have that sort of, you know, 1 over k squared catastrophic failure of the bias model as you get smaller and smaller k.
But it's not a failure of the bias model.
Well,
success of the bias model.
Well, yeah, but it's sort of what I'm saying is that you're altering the bias call to include non-Gaussianity. But if I go to, there must be a transition between k to 0.01 and larger k that isn't recognized.
I don't think there is, and actually I think as Nosar has looked at that, and you can look at this relation even beyond large superhorizon scale, and it's still the same.
Because even at very large scale, you're tracing the fluctuation with, say, a galaxy.
Which is a fluctuation formed on a smaller scale. So it's coupling between,
there's always a coupling between.
Well, I don't know how to interpret a nonlinear structure on a scale.
But there are two scales. One is the size of the galaxy, which is a small wave.
Right.
And the other is the size of the distance between galaxies.
So you always have a galaxy, but you can have them very, very far away.
But the bias is associated with that particular object.
But you have a larger scale perturbation modes that make two of them talk.
Right.
That can be as large as you want, I mean, in principle. And that's the K. So I always have two normal objects of mass M, like galaxies, mm-hmm. clusters. But then they can be very, very far separated. And then I have to, and then, you know, they chase differently. Yeah, no, I guess I don't, if I knew, understood this really that well, I'd be able to explain it simply, but I don't, I guess, so. For sure, one thing is what I can just repeat, I guess, what a few of us have said, is K and M are not the same thing. So mass of an object, you can talk about any mass here, and mass is encoded in this term, but 1 over K squared is just how separated they are.
So maybe before you move on, just one point is, there is, I think Rachel is correct in one point that this delta is not well-defined on superhorizon scale, it depends on the gauge, choice of gauge. So in that sense, this bias becomes ambiguous. So in different gauges, you can get different biases. So in one gauge, it looks like this, but then when I put the other gauge, it becomes a constant.
Good point, thank you. Good point. Analytic and numerical results agree to first order. There should be a little footnote to first order and to a very solid first order. So here's from Dalal et al. And there may have been one or two others, but Dejac, Seljak, and Iliev look at this too. And all you need to see here is that the simulations which align curves go through quote unquote measurements from simulation which are points. Here's this other paper. Don't worry, there are different ranges of, I guess, redshift. What you need to see here is that the theoretical prediction, which is a solid curve, goes through these dense points, which are simulation. So they agree, and there may be one or two small corrections. To tell you the truth, I don't think people are settled on them. They are smallish, but they may matter. Niyayish always has worked on that, and Tolly, as well as these guys predicted, they say that maybe there's a small constant you need to add. So, you know, there are attempts to derive this. And depending on which approach you are using, you may get the next correction that looks a little bit different. There's a lot of work, but just to simplify things to first order, this works from theory and simulation, but people are still arguing exactly how it should work. These are constraints. These are some very exciting recent developments. This is a paper by Slosak et al., where you used a variety of tracers from Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which is not even near optimal to do this, but they used, so anything that measures bias measures non-Gaussianity. You can look at the clustering of galaxies. So P galaxy galaxy is equal to B squared times P dark matter, and B squared is what you get in Nagasanti. Then three redshift ranges. These are measurements from the actual sky now, not from simulations. And the solid line is no non-Gaussianity, and then there's two more, which is non-Gaussianity of 100, and I forget, 500 or something FNL. So anyway, that shows that. You see it's good consistency with the Gaussian case. And then you can use quasars, you can use a spectra of galaxies, galaxies with spectra, or galaxies with no spectra. You can also use cross-correlation between CMB temperature and galaxy over density. So this is only proportional to a single power of bias coming from galaxy. These, of course, are proportional to the bias square, all of these others. And anyway, you do all that. Here's FNL of 0. These are 1, 2, and 3 sigma measurements. If you combine them, you get FNL to about plus minus 23, which, if you remember, is actually a little bit better than WMAP. This is just from Sloan. This is very exciting. And I'm sure Gentoli have worked on a similar thing. They used one of those methods, cross-correlation between galaxies and CMB. And again, here's FNL of 0, and here's FNL of another value. And they find some weak evidence, you know, 2 sigma or so, maybe a bit less, for FNL greater than 0, but error bars are still big. So this remains to be, I think this remains to be exciting area. These are the two papers with actual constraints. There have been predictions for future constraints for different surveys. And now, of course, you have to make all kinds of assumptions, other parameters, survey specifications, systematic errors is a big one. So don't worry, maybe we don't want to trust these details, but if you just look at the error bars, they are very small, and they even get to order unity, which is really amazing. Remember, this is a FNL of 1 or even 10 is very, very small. These errors are better than Planck. Anyway, the thing to take from here is that a large structure becomes as powerful as Planck or the CMB. Another thing that most theorists, if you ask, they'll say, oh, Planck will measure FNL. Now we can add large structure to the list. Yes?
For single field inflation, FNL is of order 1, or it's of order of Sloan Rover? It's kind of order 1 over 100.
Yeah.
That's right.
So there's a primordial piece, which is on the order of Sloan, but then there's also kind of a non-linear piece, just like from second order to your, that's on order of 1. And so the inflation predicts.
So in that sense, inflation predicts FNL.
Yes. That's a very good point. Thank you. And that, of course, hasn't been included into confusion with that other nonlinear FNL hasn't been included in these analyses. I'm really glad this is one of the most technical radio audiences I ever give a talk in front of. So thank you for filling in the details that I'm missing. You know, I usually give this talk for people who, like, you know, need the very basic things explained. So this is great. Let me mention one more thing, and then I'm done. This is something that my postdoc Carlos Cunha has been doing, and he's been expending a tremendous amount of effort to get this right. We also found that another, you know, kind of an obvious tracer provides basically even surprisingly strong constraints on Gaussianity. This is now future constraints again. Clustering of galaxy clusters, so counts of clusters is a mass function business. But clustering of clusters is kind of like clustering of galaxies, except clustering of bigger objects. Turns out that that can really be a powerful probe of non-Gaussianity as well. And the thing to do, to take note here, is that the idea is then you look at the sky and you make little pixels, maybe 3D bins, with cluster counts, and these go in x, y, and z directions in the sky, you know, theta, phi, and r. And the reason this is a challenging calculation is because you're doing clustering of these pixels. So if you maybe want 10 pixels in one direction, 10 pixels in the other, maybe 10 radial pixels, because you'll have automatic redshift, that's 1,000 pixels already, 1,000 bins. Then maybe you want to slice in mass as well, so then you have 10 to the 4 bins. If you're going to do clustering, then you have 10 to the 4 squared, which is 10 to the 8 clustering terms. 10 to the 8 is a large number if any one of them requires a calculation. So this is why it was actually a very challenging calculations he's done to try to see People before have considered this, but they forgot the main effect, which is not to look at the variance in each bin, but look at the far separated covariances between pixels. Because remember, it's large scales where non-Gaussianity picks up. So that main effect has been forgotten in some previous estimates. And I'm skipping a whole bunch of details. This is some preliminary results. These are unmarginalized errors in FNL, so before you marginalize over the other parameters. And this is, as you, on the x-axis is the, as you increase, as you take more and more neighbors in this picture. So you are somewhere as you take more and more neighbors. So maybe two pixel separations only take these covariances and then three and so on. Turns out calculation becomes much more challenging as you take more neighbors. But you see that these constraints on non-Gaussianity become very, very good. This is error in FNL of U. And this is error if you only use counts. And in fact, this is unmarginalized error. So the realistic error with only counts is because it's so degenerate with everything else in cosmology is way off this graph. And this is not very degenerate. So this actually degrades to maybe here somewhere as you take as you marginalize over other parameters. So it's really what we are finding is that the clustering of clusters is like two orders of magnitude better than just cluster counts, which was previously thought to be a problem in Gaussianity, but not a very good one. So this is really way to go, and we are excited about this. This is fake future data. This is not real data, just the error projections.
So Adrian was just explaining to me that even if the primordial fluctuations were purely Gaussian, that FNL observed would be of order unity. And here the best estimate asymptotes to order unity. And on the previous slide where you were showing the estimates for future surveys, the most futuristic surveys were also getting close to order unity. Is that a coincidence, or is the old thing that's ultimately limiting?
It's a coincidence. It's a coincidence because I can't imagine that nonlinear effect was taken into account implicitly here. It's a coincidence.
So
and these are not...
Is there some more futuristic survey that will be able to
measure yeah.
better?
Yeah. So we are getting spoiled here quickly. So, to decrease, it used to be that, this was like the dream or so. So now even the fact that we are talking about FNL of a few... So actually, there might be. Who knows? I mean, this is for dark energy surveys. So if you look at the LSST constraints, if we believe this number, it's 0.7. So you may, it's going to be very, very hard with systematic errors. And this I think, doesn't include degeneracy with other parameters. But it may be that we do so well that we can probe that nonlinear part of future surveys. But that's like super hard. Actually, it's less super hard than other things in cosmology. But it's hard. And I think it's amazing that we're even talking about this. But you're right. If we stay somewhere, say, here, which would be really good, we are not going to be, we need nature to be kind and provide primordial non-Gaussianity bigger than 5. Or 10.
At some point here, do you start having to worry about the trisecting effect? I mean, if depending on what's making this non Gaussian,
I don't think so.
You're trying to get to order one, though. I mean, but there are, I mean, if tau FNL is, again, isn't growing compared to FNL, then presumably you can ignore the trisecting. But I know there are cases of this where the relative size of the trispectrum is the similar order to the bispectrum. So if you're getting to the order one FNL, then I mean, isn't it at least conceivable that you would have to start worrying about tau ML?
I think it all depends on what tau ML is.
I mean, well, no, obviously, but I'm just saying.
That's the function you're worried. I see tau NL. I don't know.
I just
have no idea.
If tau NL is defined the same way as FNL, wouldn't order one mean
that
just like this is a 10 to the minus 5 effect relative to the power spectrum,
then wouldn't tell but tau NL seems to be a much bigger error number. So I mean it's in fact in some maybe it's a special case. I can't remember the details, but I remember seeing various places where it was probably like a big number like 10 to 5 ish, so that you can get FNL tiny but then big old tau.
Yeah.
And so
I've seen that too.
The part where you're saying, okay, we're finished with cosmology. Because we can get FNL small. Maybe that's not
the case. That's a good point.
I just don't know. I have no idea.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it. It's a good point. Yeah.
Oh, super duper model dependent. I'm not claiming that at all. I just thought that dragon might
have. Yeah.
In some sense, that's why if you use both counts of clustering, you kind of win, right? Because the counts is really probably all of that pair work.
Right.
So if you have something, that's where you're going to be interpreted.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. What also I forgot to say is I failed to give credit to counts, where counts should be given credit, because even though they don't do well here, they are very important in Well, the important breaking degeneracy to some other. So remember I said this is not degenerate with other parameters, the clustering. It's somewhat degenerate, and counts help break the degeneracy. I forgot to mention that. So combining counts is important even if they're not.
You didn't say how many clusters they need.
This is assuming lots of clusters, but it's of order 100,000. But this is optical, you know, clusters from the ES. This is not crazy. And it, we are hurt a little bit by, you know, cosmology of what sigma 8 of 0.8, not 0.9. Everyone's hurt. It's like, you know, the stock market hurt everyone. You know, sigma 8 hurt everyone. But okay, you know, we'll survive.
It was back up again.
Yes. Potentially, yes. There are many open questions. One is, what about other models known as Gaussianity? Some people have worked on some of them, even in this context. Systematic error control, not to degrade these projective constraints. If your microscope is shaking, that's not very good for getting FNL of 1, and so on. How best to design a survey? What objects would you like to take? Quasars, galaxies, clusters. This is the thing that Niyayesh referred to from the ones in Slosat paper. What happens if you go to these large scales? And those authors claim the B of K remains the same, but that nobody's double-checked that. What about model where FNL depends on scale? Or this is combined with the other models and so on. So in conclusion, searching for primordial non-Gaussianity is one of the most fundamental tests you can do. It's one of the few links to the early universe. We don't have too many. CMB bispectrum is most promising. And here's one sort of message I'm delivering as I go to different places, although here it's not needed. Again, if you ask theorists, they'll say, oh yeah, Planck will measure FNL, or Planck will measure non-Gaussianity. Well, now we have large scale structure. Mass function is sensitive, but not competitive with the CMB, though, like I said, mass function and counts are very important in breaking degeneracy with other parameters. Cosmological models with local primordial non-Gaussianity lead to significant scale dependence, and everybody pretty much agrees on this, including theory and simulations. Large scale structure, therefore, is an important probe, especially any type of measurement when you're measuring bias. And relative to counts alone, basically two orders of magnitude better. And sigma FNL of U is expected from future surveys. Thank you.